Shalom Aleichem, Chabad, Binyamin Hammer at the National Council of Israel. We're here to welcome Rebbe, who will, B'ezrat Hashem, enter our shilas. This is conference call number 28. Thank you, Rebbe.
Thank you very much. Question number one. An apartment building has an exterminator come once a month to treat any apartment that may have a bug issue. Often he comes on Shabbos. Is there any issue of signing up so that he will come to your apartment on Shabbos? You are not directly telling him to come then, but you know that he is certainly going to put the poison down on Shabbos. B, can I spray Raid or other poison on Shabbos where I suspect that bugs will walk in and die? Shulchan Aruch writes in Orachaim Siman Shin Tez Zayin Sif Yud, to kill bugs is prohibited, although, as the Mishnah Brura writes in Sifkot Memches, it's a Derabbanon, you have no need for the body of the bug that you killed. Having said that, we have a principle found in the Shulchan Aruch in Shin Zayin Sif Hei. It was a Tzorech Harbe, a great need. There's a principle known as Shvus to Shvus Mutter, which means you tell a non-Jew to do an Issa D'Rabbanan, which normally we prohibit, but in certain limited cases, such as for a mitzvah, or for a Tzorech Harbe, for a great need, it is permissible. Now, it's hard to evaluate in every case how great the need is to have the exterminator come. In some cases, it can be a very, very great need because the people feel very uncomfortable living in a house where there's so many bugs. In addition, it's interesting to discuss exactly whose agent is this exterminator. From my understanding, generally it's being paid not by the tenant, but by the landlord. And the landlord also is not just helping out the tenant, but he has a stake in it as well because he wants the entire apartment building to be free of bugs as much as possible so that other people will rent and the people will be happy. So therefore, it's arguable that this fellow is really doing a job on behalf of the landlord and not so much on behalf of the tenant. True, the tenant signs up. That is true. But nonetheless, since the landlord is paying him, and it's for the landlord's self-interest as well, it's arguable that fundamentally he's an employee and even an agent, a shaliach, of the landlord and not the tenant, which of course mitigates the issue of Amiyol and Achri, because if you tell him in advance, it's primarily based upon shlichus, and here he's probably not your shaliach, he's a shaliach of the landlord, certainly primarily. More than that, he's not killing the bugs directly. He is simply putting down whatever poison he puts down, and the bugs will die later. So that's another reason to be a bit more lenient in this case, and therefore, in my opinion, if it's a great need, it's permissible to sign up to have the non-Jewish exterminator come. B is much more complex. Because B is, can I spray Raid? This is talking about the Jewish individual himself. That's already a more complicated story. In the Sefer Shmir Shabbos Kilchasa, in Perek Chafei and Siv Zayin, he prohibits putting down Raid or the like for two reasons. One, the poison is mukta. You can't even touch it. Two, it's what he calls a grama of Netilas Neshama. In other words, if you spray the Raid directly on the bug and he dies on the spot, that's Netilas Neshama. You've killed a live being, which is direct prohibition. If you spray the Raid in place A, and the bug, who's in place B, will then walk his way over in 10 minutes and then die, that's a classical case of grama. Now, grama, generally speaking, is prohibited. If you look in Shulchan Aruch and Siman Shin Lamed Daled Sifchav Beis, the Rambam writes, it's permissible the Mokum Hefsed. And this might be considered to be a Mokum Hefsed because, after all, people who can't tolerate to live in their apartment when there are bugs all over the place, that is perhaps the equivalent of Mokum Hefsed. Especially, as we said before, the entire Isser here is Midrabbanan, Saint Shulchan Gufa. And more than that, question says, I suspect that bugs will walk in and die. It's only a suspicion. It may not happen. Interestingly, in the Shmir Shabbos, in Ha'ara Lamites, he talks about a problem of Asiyas Grav Sharei Lechatchila. That's supposed to make something disgusting, which you'll have to move away, Lechatchila. If it's there, you're allowed to move it, otherwise not. That question was raised by one of the poskim. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman says that issue goes away in a very common case in which the animal ingests the poison and then moves somewhere else and dies somewhere else, or sometimes even carries the poison somewhere else. So therefore, there's not going to be a dead bug where you are. It's going to be in the inner recesses of the house where these bugs hide out, and there will not be a problem of making Grav Sharei Lechatchila. So it could be, with the cheshen of Grav Sharei, which means something which is disgusting, they suspended the prohibition of Muksa. It's possible, not only does it apply to the bug itself, but even to something else which is necessary to avoid the bug being visible there. For example, the Miri writes in Shabbos Mem Zayin, it's permissible to move dirt, offer, which is Muksa, in order to cover up the Grav Sharei. Shlomo Zalman quotes this in Shmir Shabbos, Perek Chav Beis, Ha'ara Kuf Chav Dalet, and he has a tzarachin, whether it's correct or not correct. If it is correct, so not only is the dirt, which would be used to cover up a disgusting creature, be permissible to move because of Grav Sharei, so too would apply to the raid or to the poison, which Shlomo Zalman had mentioned earlier, it was a problem of Muksa, but if it's going to, in order to cover up or eliminate a Grav Sharei, it might be permissible as well. Bottom line, it's a bit of more complicated, problematic for the Jew to do it himself, but in a very big Shas HaTzrach, if you're not spraying directly on the bugs, only a suspicion, they may walk in, we can be lenient from the perspective of Grumma, because it's considered a Hefset. And from the perspective of Muksa, we can be lenient on the base of Grav Sharei. That's question one. Question two. For the issue of Netilas Yadayim upon awakening, can one count the entire house as Dal Amis? The Mishnah Berurah says yes, but the source he quotes seems to have been talking about a room and not the entire house. It's indeed correct. If you look at the Shari Tshuva, Simon Aleph's is Cotton Bays. He quotes the Eli Rabba, Siv Cotton Bays, where he says that it means a room. But if you look further in that same Shari Tshuva, which is the source, he writes that the Beis Yosef did not quote this din in the first place. In other words, the whole idea of not walking four amos is not quoted. It's not quoted in the Shulchan Aruch. Beis Yosef doesn't pask in this way, apparently. The source is presumably a Zohar. The Birkei Yosef, the Chidah, says it's not a Zohar. Some say it's a Ksav Yad in the Zohar. You look on Shari Tshuva. And in general, we are only obligated to follow laws which are found in the Gemara. Whatever's found in the Zohar cannot possibly be obligatory because we're not even required to know about it. The entire Torah we're required to know. That's called Nigla. Whatever's called Nistar, found in Zohar, we're not really required even to know it, and Kavachom we're not required to follow it. It's fundamentally sowed. So therefore, I would say, even if the original source, Eli Rabba, is limiting himself to a room, one could extend it to the house, since the entire problem in the first place is not a real halacha. There's no source in the Gemara. Kotei Rav Yosef Karo, no source even in the Zohar. And even if it has a source, it's not mandatory. Someone wants to be more machmir, so we know the Bichlul custom. Those who want to be more machmir, they put what they call negel vasa right near the bed, and that solves the entire problem. But those who don't want to follow that kumra, it seems to me they can rely on the washing hands when they get to the bathroom on the grounds that the whole din is not really a total obligation, clean obligation, and it's in the same house. And although it's beyond the room, it might be permissible in any event. Question number 3. What are the parameters of an Ovel participating in a Kiddush or Fruv Shabbos meal? That's how I'm reading it. And the wedding after Shloshim, but within the, quote, year for parents. This is a very important question, which is the numerous permutations which relate to this. There were really three levels of, we'll call them, pseudos mitzvah with respect to people who are in Avelis. The most lenient, which is not here, is a siyum. The poskim say that by right, a person can go to a siyum even if he's in Avelis. If you look on the side of the Aradea, a bar mitzvah properly observed, as we say, not more bar than mitzvah, but bar mitzvah, which is supposed to celebrate a siyum ha-Torah. That's what it's supposed to be all about, if I understand it. Those two would be permissible for an Avel to participate in, just as there are those who say it's permissible for the Avel to be the Kiddush on Simchas Torah, the Mishnah Berurah writes, all because they are Suda Shel Torah. A Suda of Torah is permissible for an Avel. The other extreme, there is a wedding and a Sheva Brachos, which are considered to be a Beis HaSimcha Alpi Din, and they are the most strict. The details we'll get to momentarily. In between are other Tudor Shal Mitzvah, and there's a whole list of them. An Ofruf would be one, a Kiddush, you could put a Bris, and a Shalom Zach, and a Pidyon HaBen, things of this nature. That's the middle group. Seems to me, based upon looking at the postgame, and there are many opinions over here, as you can well imagine, that for the middle group, if an individual feels that he or she has to be there, it's totally permissible to enter, to wish Mazel Tov, to circulate. However, one should not eat, because in order to, if you're eating there, it's more strict. And frankly, there's no need, coming to a Kiddush, there's no need to eat there. You would probably all be healthier if we didn't eat at the Kiddush. So in this particular situation of this year, the person should go to the Kiddush and wish Mazel Tov, and walk around and say hello to people, shake hands, and, go home and eat. That's the best thing. When it comes to an Ofruf Shabbos meal, that's a different story. There it's a meal already. So I would say that it's a problem. And even if your lack of attendance is attributable to the Avelis, and there's a question known as Avelis Befarhesi on Shabbos, the Shach says that Avelis Befarhesi is prohibited only for the more intense form of Avelis, which is the Avelis of Shiva. That's why you have to put on your leather shoes and put on your unripped garment and things of this nature. But the lower level of Avelis of Shloshim, the Shach suggests, would not be eliminated by Shabbos. That's why a person who's clean-shaven doesn't shave before Shabbos during the Shloshim, even though it's obvious, he walks into the shul into a that he's an Avelis, because it's a Shloshim level of Avelis. This is also a Shloshim level, and therefore, according to that one opinion in the Shach, which many accept, there's no heter of Farhesia when it comes to Avelis of Shloshim. And there's also, there is an opinion which maintains there's no real heter of Farhesia if your absence can be attributed to something else. The person didn't feel well, had another commitment, whatever it may be. On the other hand, often the Suda for the Ofruf is only a family affair. Only the family is there. If only the family is there, then it's permissible for the individual in Avelis to join in that Suda, because in general, there's no restrictions on joining in family meals, no matter how large the family is. In America, we're used to the nuclear family, a father, a mother, and two kids. But if you read back in history of Europe, and if you go to probably the Borough Park or to certain Sephardi communities nowadays, there's a large family eating together. Some of this involves grandparents and their children and many of their grandchildren who are only cousins. It's still permissible as long as it's kept within the family. That's as far as the Ofruf Shabbos meal is concerned. A wedding is the most serious, and frankly, if it's a person should stay home. The best thing for a wedding is to stay home, not go to any weddings during the year of Elis, which is the strict halacha. There could be a shas atzchak, some reason which it's hard to go into now, what the shas atzchak might be. If that would be the case, the person should just walk in for the chuppah and then go home. Should not even walk into the, what we'll call the wedding hall where the dancing and the meal take place. If someone is a close relative, I emphasize the word close because if you go to relatives in this context, it's not appropriate to extend it to cousins. I recall that when I was in Avelis for my mother, my first cousin, who was very close, had a wedding for his oldest daughter. And he said, you know, we can find a heter. And I said, I'm staying home. My wife went, I stayed home. And he said, you know, you're right. That's really the right thing to do. You know, if you're for your mother, stay home. Even though, again, a very close first cousin was making this wedding. So, but there could even be close relationships. What happens if someone's in Avelis and a sibling is making a wedding or a sibling is getting married? That's a different story. There, I believe that the Avil should attend the wedding. How do you do it exactly? Well, you can come for the pictures. If you're related closely enough, they take pictures in advance. The wedding hasn't started yet. That should be okay. I believe it's permissible to be in the chuppah room. That's okay. If you have to be in the, we call the Kabbalah's Panim room, if necessary, and that sometimes it is. Again, eat nothing, because if you eat nothing, it's more lenient. And if you want to stay beyond the chuppah because you're a very close relative and everyone wants to say hello to you because you're such a close member of the family, you should try to find an off-site location. Depends exactly, you know, where that is. Depends on the place where the wedding is held. It also depends on the circumstances. Well, my son got married when I was in Avelis to my father, and technically speaking, if it's a father and a son, it's probably permissible to be there. However, my sister was in Avelis, was also there, and the wedding was in a hotel in Yerushalayim. And we had a room upstairs in one of the higher floors. So my sister and I went upstairs, and we had a delicious meal, and then we came down, and they didn't have to eat anywhere near the wedding hall proper. That's not always possible. I was just last week, my wife, who's now in Avelis, for her mother, her sister married off a child, and so, of course, she followed these guidelines, and when it came to after the chuppah, they arranged a closed room down the hall, fairly far away from where everybody else was. I would have preferred on the second floor, but it wasn't. It's a school building. It wasn't really so possible. And whoever wanted to say hello to my wife and her brother who were in that room came to that room. So it was a closed room. It wasn't part of the wedding party at all. And I think that's permissible. What I don't like is they sometimes put a table right outside the wedding hall. Everybody's there. The music is blaring. It's just a few feet away from the door to the hall where there's dancing and eating. I don't think that separation suffices. Therefore, again, it all depends on how close the relationship is. Again, if it's someone beyond a sibling, it's more problematic. Perhaps we can have certain cases where an aunt and an uncle are closer than a cousin, and they sometimes have a certain parental role in certain little few cases. It's hard to give a general answer, but the guidelines that we gave, I think, apply to all such situations. Question number 4. It seems that the general custom is not to follow the guidelines that the Shulchan Aruch mentions regarding attending a funeral for someone who is a Talmud, Chacham, or a Rebbe. Based on Shulchan Aruch, it would seem that if a Rebbe passes away, the entire town would have to come to the funeral. What is the reason for this? it's a little bit complicated. In Yerodea, in Simon Shin Samach Aleph Siv Gimel, it says, a roach mace, tzorach lulav also. If you see anybody who passes away and the Leviath is passing near you, you're required to accompany the mace, at least for Arba Amos, says the Shulchan Aruch. What happens if you don't see the funeral passing by? You just know about it. You didn't see anything. So there's a machlokes. If you look at Bari HaShulchan, from Fivel Cohen, Shalita, in Shin Samach Aleph, Sivkot and Dalet, he quotes a machlokes. The meaning is that we are not required, and that applies in that context even to a Talmud Chacham. Look carefully at the beginning of Simon Shin Samach Aleph and Sif Aleph. So therefore, there is no obligation, strictly speaking, from the din of the Shulchan Aruch, to attend a levaya of anyone in town, even if it's a Talmud Chacham, because you don't see it, but you don't see. The fact that you know about it doesn't matter. Also important is how you define a city. New York City is very big. If a person is going to go to every Talmud Chacham in New York City's Levaya, then forget about it. That's all you'll be doing all day and all night. Having said that, if a person has a connection, a personal connection, or I would say connection of the soul with the Talmud Chacham or Rebbe, he certainly should go to the Levaya, even if it involves a trip. It depends, of course, how long and how close. But, these are all difficult considerations. This is also a consideration of Bittul Torah, which is discussed both in the Gemara and in the Shulchan Aruch there. So it's the question becomes, is this question number four referring to a plain person who's otherwise wasting his time? They should certainly go to the mitzvah of the Levaya Sameis. If the person who's busy learning, it's not so simple. So every case has to be evaluated individually. Question number five. How important is it for there to be a shomer for a mace? Answer, it's very important. So before Shul Gemara, Mesach the Brachas, Yud Chesem and Aleph, he's even part of Mikrishma. However, if you look in the Gemara, shomer means shomer mipneo achborim. If the body is not protected, Chas v'Shalom could be degraded by rats or other predators, and therefore there's an absolute chiyuv of shmira to protect the mace. However, this chiyuv terminates once the mace is put into a refrigerator, which is typically done these days, either in a hospital or in a funeral home, and the room is locked, and there's no possible degradation to the mace. So therefore, you ask how important it is. It's really not important at all from the perspective of the Gemara, because there are no achbarim. The Mishnah Berurah writes in Siman Ayin Aleph Sifkotin Yud Beis that the only time you're potter from Kriya Shema is you show him in achbarim. That's the Gemara. If you're worried about rats, but just to other than that, not now. Having said that, you want to give cover to the mace by reciting Tehillim. You want to recite the Tehillim in the hospital or in the funeral home or wherever it happens to be, whether you're in the house. The house is not yet refrigerated, but it's in either the hospital or in the funeral home. And instead of saying Tehillim in your own home, you want to say Tehillim in the proximity of the room where the mace is found. It's not literally in front of him, because it's usually a locked room or in a refrigerated compartment where you can't really see the mace, but you're either 5 feet away, or maybe they make you 25 feet away if they send you out of that room. Sometimes the room is even locked. Yes, of course, it's a greater cover for the mace if the Tehillim is being recited nearby, but that's not the Shemir de Gemara, and therefore it wouldn't be part of in Kriya Shema, and therefore it has to be judged against whatever else you might be doing at that time. Maybe there's a greater thing you can do for cover the mace. Maybe to sit and learn either the Shmasa or to say Tehillim, we can focus better. That's a judgment call. But again, it's very important to be a shomer for a mace, yes. But in the Gemara, Brachos Yud Chesem and Aleph, it's Mipnei Achborim, and that's what the Mishnah Berurah quotes it and Siman Ayin Aleph, Sivkot on Yud Beis as well. Question number 6. After eating which cheeses are you required to wait 6 hours? Shachan Yerodeya, Siman Pei Tes, Sivkot and Tezayin. If it's aged and sharp, approximately 6 months. Now, I was shown the OU as a beautiful article called Aged Cheese List, which is written by Rabbi Gornemer, who is an expert in the kashrus of dairy products. I'm sure you can get it from the OU online. I just have it in front of me. It says OU Kosher, with a whole bunch of things. And it says kosher/aged-cheese-list. There's not a slash. I'm sure you can all find it. They give you an entire list. We'll go over some of the klolim which are found here, both in the list and the before and after. What they call here, it's an alphabetical order. American cheese, that's when we grew up, that was it. It was American cheese. That is made from cheddar that is aged only a few months, 2 months or less. And that is not a problem, because as we said before, it has to be 6 months approximately, or the equivalent. Speaking of cheddar, they have over here, if it's medium, sharp, or aged cheddar, with 6 months, it could be as much as 7 years, that would be a problem. So cheddar cheese, unless we know otherwise, would be a problem if it's medium, sharp, and aged, as opposed to if it's just mild, what they call regular. These things, of course, can be seen on the label. One of the famous questions is Parmesan cheese. And they write here that it's aged for a year or two, should certainly be a problem. But there's a fascinating footnote in this article, which is footnote number 5. Foods that are quote-unquote officially contain very aged cheeses are often made with less expensive, fresh, non-aged cheeses. For example, eggplant Parmesan is frequently made with cheeses other than Parmesan. They use mozzarella. Mozzarella is, again, only aged for a very short period of time. And therefore, it would not be necessary to wait 6 hours. The next footnote quotes Yad Yehuda in Sivkot and Lamed in Siman Pei Tes, who says that a Tavshil Shel Gvina is not required to wait 6 hours. Here's the discussion. What does that mean? What do the words mean? Does it mean a tafshil shel gvina, in which the cheese is not discernible? Or does it mean any situation in which the cheese is melted and therefore loses some of the sharpness that it had? And therefore, it also loses its brittle texture that it had. And there are two reasons we have to wait 6 hours, either because it got stuck between your teeth, presumably would not happen once it's melted, and even the sharpness is somewhat mitigated once it's melted. And therefore, even though they quoted that the poskim and the OU are more strict and say the Yad Yehuda should be limited to a case in which the cheese is not discernible, the author writes so correctly that the logic seems to be inclined more in the lenient direction. Nonetheless, since there are those who are strict, what I advise is as follows. We should be makil, instead, not to eat the meat right away, but to wait for 1 hour. You're probably familiar with the fact that when it comes to, even from meat to milk, now 1 hour is the real din. Beyond that is a minig or chumash we've all accepted upon ourselves. Anyone has a reach Torah as the shach. But in this other direction, where it's from cheese to meat, and the cheese has been melted, so according to the Pashup Shah and Yad Yehuda, you don't have to wait at all. I would say, in deference to those who have a different interpretation of Yad Yehuda, should wait for 1 hour. That's what I would say about this halach. Question number 7. I'm a Rav out of town where the community day school is struggling with enrollment, quality of education, and religious level of the student and parent body. The only option I have is to send my 5th and 6th grade children to live by grandparents and uncles. What are the guidelines to stay in the community and continue my rabbinic position, or to leave for the sake of the chinuch of our children? impossible to answer this question based on what's written here, because there's so many variables, both personal variables and communal variables. For example, the nature of the children. How would they do out of the house? The nature of the grandparents and the uncles. How would they treat a relative coming from far away? Moreover, if the person leaves his rabbinic position, what's he going to do? How will he support his family? Secondly, the other consideration is, what happens to the community? If the rabbi leaves his position, what does he predict was going to happen? Will they hire another rabbi that's similar to himself? In which case, it's more pressing to follow the family needs, since the community needs will be fulfilled anyway, in a similar fashion, by a different rav. Or, as is often the case, the rabbi is holding on to the traditional rabbinate, and he's fearful that he leaves and the position will be filled by someone who will not be as strong as he is in keeping the faith, if you will, and it will lead to a lowering of the standards of religious observance and Torah study in the community. That imposes a much greater responsibility on the rabbi to stay, to man his post as long as he possibly can, to prevent the yerida, so the lowering of standards in his community. And as far as it's concerned about his children, it's quoted from a number of gedolim that they promised, as much as could be promised in these cases, rabbis and mechanchim who go out of town, the Kadosh Baruch Hu will give the siyata d'shmaya that the children will come out okay. That's obviously, I can't give any guarantees, but that that idea has been quoted in the name of a number of gedolim of the last generation, so that if a person decides he really wants to stay to man his post and to prevent a spiritual lowering of standards in the community that he occupies, and even though the children will have to go to grandparents or uncles and aunts, if they can handle it, they means both the children and the grandparents, then the rabbi should stay to avoid the lowering of the religious standards, and Kadosh Baruch Hu should bless him, so his children will come out great. Question number 8. A congregant's parents passed away in 85, 92, were buried in a cemetery which is now in very bad condition. They've complained to the owner, has changed hands, the current owner is not doing anything to improve conditions, even though many buried there have paid for perpetual care. The congregant wants to know if he should or shouldn't have his parents moved to a better place. Does it help to move them to Eretz Yisrael? Is it recommended to do so in such a case? So what does it mean, very bad condition? What do the words mean? To some it means they promise perpetual care, they'll manicure the grass, they'll pull out the weeds, and whatever overgrowth will be trimmed. Halachically, that's not such a significant consideration at all. Although they promised perpetual care and didn't deliver, that's not really so significant. It's primarily for looks. And therefore, in such a case, we should not move the parents' bodies. This is quoted in Shulchan Aruch and Siman Shin Samach Gimel Sif Aleph in the Oradea. Why may we not move the mace? So again, the Beis Yosef, the next Siman is quoted as saying, "Bnei Kvod HaMace," not honor to the mace to move his body. This is quoted by Bari HaShulchan and Tziyunim Oz Beis. And again, in Sifkot Aleph, gives many other reasons why we do not move a body from one place to the other. And Shulchan Aruch, they write in Sif Aleph, even quote, "Mibazui lemechubod," from a grave which is not so honorable to a grave which is more honorable by its location, etc. So therefore, even though it's in quote unquote a very bad condition, if it just means that it's bazui, not so nice, you can move the mace to another finely manicured cemetery, that's not a reason to allow it, and it should not be done. The Eretz Yisrael, well, Shulchan Aruch says it's permissible to move the body to Eretz Yisrael, but that doesn't mean it's, you have to do it. Just imagine every single person who is buried will decide, family decides to move them all to Eretz Yisrael. That's not the case. We generally speaking would discourage even some Eretz Yisrael, even though it's permissible. The only time it's a problem is what's called a kevesh eino mishtamer. Shulchan Aruch writes there in Shin Samach Gimel Aleph. What does that mean? There's a kilkel in the kever itself. How? Either it's water, as the Shulchan Aruch puts it, or goyim. Means the non-Jews there who are chalila grave snatching or otherwise degrading the grave itself. But the Shulchan writes an oath Yubeis, as opposed to where this was called Kalus Rosh, that the Regoyim were not conduct themselves properly in the cemetery, but they don't touch the grave itself. That itself would not be a reason to move the mace. But if it's really a degradation of the grave proper, or not non-Jews doing it, but water is doing it, then not only is it permissible to move the mace, it's even the mitzvah to do so. We now turn to question number 9. I teach in a day school every morning. If there's a funeral that needs to be scheduled, is it permissible or advisable for me to ask that it be postponed until after I finish teaching? It make a difference if there are financial repercussions for me too many days off. Does it matter that the school will not be able to find a sub and the students' total learning will, that one will suffer? Would it matter if the postponement is 15 minutes or 3 hours? All good questions. We know there's an Indian of Halana Tameis. However, that's only when the day passes. If a Levi is postponed from 11 o'clock in the morning to 1 in the afternoon, that is not Halana Tameis. All you're doing, it's what we call a bittul of Zrizim Magdimin, the mitzvah, the mitzvah of Kura. Truth is, even when a Rebbe is not involved, not every funeral takes place at the top of the morning. After all, it should, strictly speaking, if the person passed away the day before, you know, in the evening, it was too late to do it that day. They should call the Levi for the first minute of the day, as early as it possibly can, so that you can bring the Aron to the cemetery as soon as it opens, and fulfill this reason, Makdimin, to the midst of Kruah. That's usually not done. Frequently, the Levi is pushed to the afternoon for frivolous reasons. Therefore, this Malame, this Rebbe in the yeshiva, who, if he's missing, even if you do find the sub, as those of us in education know, is a measure of Bittul Torah, certainly if you don't, then there's the issue of his parnasa, which also is significant. It seems to me that we should not use the word postponed. It's a bad word. Rather use the word the Levi will be set for a certain time. The Levi will be set for noon instead of 10 o'clock, just to give an example. No postponement. It was set for noon. This happens every day of the week. There's a funeral at noon. No one's explaining to you why. Why not at 9 in the morning? That's just the way it is. It should not be interpreted as a postponement. I think it's ill-advised for a variety of reasons. The rabbi puts his interest ahead of the family, ahead of the community, whatever. Just that it was set for a bit of a later time. Now, what happens if the family really wants to do the right thing, which is have the funeral first thing in the morning? Then, yes, the rabbi has to miss his shir, go to the levaya, which he has to officiate at, to try, if at all possible, to limit the bittul Torah. But if there is going to be some, this says in the Shulchan Aruch, Shin Samach Aleph Sefal, Mevatlin Talmud Torah Lo Tzoa Sameis. That here's a case where the two clash. Tzoa Sameis is on a higher level. True, did not discuss Talmud Torah de Rabin and what its halach is and how you define it. I refer you to the Gemara Masechta Megillah, Daf Gimel Amud Aleph and Amud Beis, and the Rashash has two pieces in Amud Aleph and Amud Beis about this. It's a bit complex, and it's obviously cannot be discussed fully because every case is somewhat different. I don't see 15 minutes or 3 hours. Maybe 15 minutes is less of a problem because they can call the Leviathan at the same time. You come a few minutes late. That's not so terrible. You tell them in advance you have a commitment to the yeshiva. You want to make it to 12 o'clock? I can't get until 12:15. They accepted it. So if that's what happens, it may happen in that fashion. These are very important considerations, and there are many others which you cannot summarize in the absence of the facts and the sensitivities and what the family is like and what the yeshiva and the rebbe are like. So these are just, again, general guidelines. Final question, number 10. A patient with cancer has lost appetite and was put in a feeding tube to the stomach. He has lost control of bathroom function. Not sure if this is from cancer or the feeding tube side effects. Currently, he is in a diaper and assumes that cannot put on tefillin, learn Torah, and say brachos. There's no bad odor, but he says that there could be the equivalent of a bowel movement at any time. But the fact that there is perpetually tzor b'mkoma indeed prohibit him from brachos, Torah study, and tefillin. Is the leniency because covered and no bad odor? Even if Torah study is forbidden, what type of hashkafa tapes or reading may he do? All good questions. The Mishnah Brura in Siman Ayin Vav Sivkot and Tezayin has a case similar where a person has some hemorrhages and there seems to always be something coming out mixed in with a Reach Ra. It's prohibited to say the Shema. However, here, it's different. Why? Why is it different? The language, again, of the question is as follows. It could be the equivalent of a bowel movement at any time. That means it's only, it could be, but it's not necessarily the case. Therefore, if it's not always the case, my suggestion is that you cover up the area. It's true, there's a dispute if covering up will help in this case. If you look in the Dirshul Mishnah Brura there in footnote 23, quotes of Machlokas of the Gedolei Poskim. Here, where it's not a constant drip of a foul odor, as described in Ayin Vav Sivkot and Tezayin, it's only sometimes it's more lenient, and we can rely upon the lenient opinions. If it's covered up and there's no smell, there are those who say if there would have been a smell, you can use a spray, deodorizers, which is a more powerful perfume smell, which will in effect cover up the foul odor. Some say that works as well. Having said that, if the individual is clear to him that something in fact did leak out and there's some stuff perhaps still stuck, Torbim coma, so he should, you know, clean himself, have necessarily someone who cleans him, and put on a fresh diaper, and at that point in time, we can be more lenient again. The Nishmas Adam, Klal Gimel Sivkot and Vav, suggests that the whole Chumrah of Torbim coma is only Midrabbanan, when there's no Reach Ra. And therefore, perhaps you wouldn't be, could be Yotze B'diavad if you said the Shema already, or even Shmon Esri. And therefore, we have a rule, Shas HaTchak, or Shas HaTchak Gadol, in our case, would be treated as a B'diavad, as long as there's no Reach Ra, especially in the case where there's a doubt whether anything is really there at this point in time. And therefore, the whole idea of the question was to say, there's a person who is perpetually tzor b'mkoma. I don't know about that. It's perpetually, the previous sentence says, there could be the equivalent of a bowel movement at any time. But it's not perpetual. It could be some time when, in point of fact, it is clean. is green. And therefore, when you're in doubt, it seems to me it's permissible to learn Torah, put on tefillin for a minute and take it off. When should you do that? As soon as you clean yourself, as soon as you went to the bathroom and cleaned yourself, or someone cleans you, that's probably the best time to assume that there'll be at least a break before anything else leaks, and that would be the best time to do it. If, in fact, it would be usher to say Kriya Shema to daven, it would also be usher to think about Divrei Torah or tape, because, after all, Mevoa Samatunafim, now it's a question of speaking Divrei Torah, even hearing Divrei Torah would be prohibited. However, as I said before, in most cases it's permissible, since the Shas HaTzach HaGadol, otherwise he won't be able to learn or to daven ever. The Shas HaTzach HaGadol, we can be lenient with the spray, certainly as long as he doesn't know that something is coming out. If and when he feels something is coming out, then I believe it's preferred that if it's at all possible to have him to clean himself up, have himself cleaned up, then to learn or daven or say Kriya Shema. And if your person adds the idea of this fragrant spray, which will obviate the Reach Ra, that would be better. This concludes the 10 questions.
Thank you, Rebbe, very much. We hope we can call upon you again before the summer begins, Mitzvah.
Thank you.
Okay, take care, everybody.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.